Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
I just remembered, I don't know if this is relevant, because we talked to some people after the reading or whatever. Mm-hmm. I just remember one woman specifically came up to me afterwards and said, I thought Adam was going to come out. I thought he was gay the whole time. And then afterwards, she told me that she thought that my character was gay because I was wearing purple skinny jeans. Which is like...
I'm Dan Nalen, and welcome to, once again, the Soundwaves from the Underground. This is the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug, an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, is one of the oldest independent publications in the United States, distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action, sports, and subculture. On this episode, we have a lot of great stuff lined up. We have Squatters brewmaster Jason Stock in the house for an interview. We talk to Plan B theater actors from Adam and Steve in the Empty Sea, the newest production from Plan B Theater, and we're going to talk to community group Revolution United. We have a real treat today. We have the brewmaster of the pub downtown, the Squatters Pub. Jason Stock is right here in our lovely Jeanette DeMose studios. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in. And we always love to hear what new things are coming down the pipe. But why don't we just dive into some different styles you have going on right now? Or maybe why don't we just start with what's the latest and greatest that we need to know about at Squatters right now?
All right. Probably the most exciting thing we've had going on in recent memory, actually, is we just finished a beer called French Connection. To be fair, it's almost gone already. But it was a pretty fun project because we used a hop that nobody else in the world is using right now.
Oh.
My friend Dave McKean, who's a brewer and chemist over at the Utah Brewers Cooperative, he was friends with some guys up at Washington State University in their agricultural program.
Oh, okay.
And they sent us this whole new variety of hop they wanted to test out. So it was fun and wildly popular. If we can get our hands on another 10 pounds of that, you might see this beer again.
Now, you know, when you get something like that where nobody has used it before, I mean, how do you go about making a version that's just, like, even for you to taste before you know you want to make a big batch, or if that's the right way?
Well, in this case, the only real variable is that hop. We know enough about the hop to be able to calculate our IBU, which is a measurement of how bitter the beer will be.
Okay.
You can smell the hop before you actually brew with it, and we made a little bit of a tea with just a small fraction of the amount of hops we had to give us an idea of what it would taste like.
Okay.
Once it's cooked, and then what we did is we used a grain bill, or a recipe for the malt in the beer, that was identical to our full suspension pale ale.
Okay.
So we're already really familiar with that malt. We know what that's going to taste like.
Right.
And really what we wanted to do is showcase this new hop. And that's part of why Washington State had us use it, is they wanted to get the feedback and have somebody brew up. We did 10 barrels of it. And we bottle some, we send it back to them.
Okay.
We take customer and employee comments about the beer, and we're just kind of compiling all that and sending it back to them. So.
How did you come up with the name French Connection? Where did that come into play?
The honest answer, it just popped into my head one day.
It sounded good.
No big thought.
Saw the movie that night.
I'm sorry, that's not fair. I just realized we haven't talked about the actual hop is a hybrid cross between a French Alsace hop and then an American Cascade hop. And so the real thing is we're using this new French hop in the beer, so that's how that came about.
Okay. So if you're hearing this podcast right now, you might want to go make a beeline straight to these Squatters downtown and see if there's any left.
You're probably too late.
Probably out of luck. Okay, and let's say
there's a lot of other great beers.
Yeah, what else is sort of new? Let's just say maybe this winter, what do you have going seasonally right now that is a highlight for people out there?
Well, one of our more popular beers we try to brew at least four times a year so I don't get strung up is Espresso Stout. That just went on draft last Thursday. I expect that to be on through about the time this airs, which I think we said was February 4th.
Yeah.
We also have a Smoked Porter that's on draft right now, which is really nice. We've just kind of been getting off on smoked beers for some reason lately. We also have a strong Scottish ale. As right now, it's unnamed, but that'll be in the bottle and probably be going on sale right about the time this airs.
Is there a way? What is a Scottish ale, I guess, compared to what we might know as, I don't know, an American ale or something? Or what makes it a Scottish style?
Scottish style ales are decidedly malty in comparison to your typical American beer. The one we're going after, modeled after a beer called the Jacobite Ale from a brewery called Tricare House Brewery in Scotland. I might be wrong on this, but I believe they're the oldest continual producer of Scottish ale.
Oh, wow.
They tend to be kind of red in color, malty, higher in alcohol. Ours will probably be about 7.75%.
Oh, okay.
And then the difference in this one is it's spiced with coriander, which when I first heard it, I thought that does not sound
not
good. And then I tasted it years ago, and it's become one of my all-time favorite beers.
Oh, nice.
Anyone that's interested, you can pick up bottles of Tricare House. Jacobite Ale is the name of their beer. At the liquor store on 3rd and 3rd has it. I think any of the kind of wine store locations will have it.
Right.
It's a little spendy. It's about $4.95 for a 12-ounce bottle, but... do yourself a favor.
Give it a little sample, right? Yeah. It's a lot worse prices out there.
That's true.
$5 a bottle or something like that. How often do you, you know, obviously as a brewer, you're a curious man. You sample beers from all over and you want to not just replicate it, but you have your own ideas.
Sure.
How much time do you get to just play? Is that as big a part of the job as you might hope, or is it something that you have to do it just a few times a year with, say, you know, a small batch, like something weird like French Connection pops up, you know?
Yeah, well, that's what I love about my job as a pub brewer. At the level we are, we get a lot more freedom to play around than the guys at a bigger brewing facility. For example, the Utah Brewers Cooperative, who I'm technically part of that, more like a satellite brewery to those guys.
Okay.
But they can't just decide, hey, we're gonna mess around today and just brew a new beer and see how it goes, because they have to consider, you know, packaging, marketing, and the fact that they're going to make more in one batch than I'll make all year, volume-wise.
Yeah.
And so we get to play around quite a bit. My assistant and I, we'll try to just... either if he's had a good beer, I've had a good beer, we'll talk about it, buy them, talk about them, come up with a recipe. And then a lot of the times we just look at each other and say, what do you want to be drinking in February? What do you want to be drinking in March? And then we just decide that way.
So. How far in advance do you plan? Like, are you planning summer 2013 now, or is it more of a...
loosely.
One, you know, couple months?
There's certain beers that have just come to be expected from our brewery, so...
Sure.
For example, McGrew's Dry Irish Stout. I pretty much have to have that on for St. Patrick's Day, or I'll get killed. And then for Cinco de Mayo, we've been, as long as I've been at Squatters, making a beer called Acapulco Gold, which is a Mexican light lager. And then, you know, our Oktoberfest beer... coming out in, strangely enough, early October.
Hey, Oktoberfest at Snowbird comes out in August, so
right,
at least you guys are on it.
So there are certain expectations within that. We have our flagship beers that we're always brewing, but we get plenty of wiggle room. Probably two or three times a month even, where we had the opportunity to come up with a whole new beer. A lot of times we'll just kind of pull something out of the bag of tricks that we've already brewed.
Right, yeah.
And that goes back to, you know, customers are kind of, they have beers they look forward to coming out. Espresso Stout's a big one. I hear, if I don't have that on, I'm hearing about it until I put it back on. So.
Have you had beers where, you know, you and the guys on your team have made it, you like it, you know it's good, and then it just is a clunker with the public? Or maybe vice versa, maybe there's something that you don't think is, not that you would put out something that's not your best work, but maybe put out something that's not your personal taste and people go crazy for it? Or
I think we've probably had both experiences. the French Connection is a decent example of that. I thought we made a great, solid beer, but I wasn't as excited as our staff and a lot of my good friends tried it. You know, one of my best friends tried it. He's like, this is the best beer you've ever made. And
said...
well, thank you, and I like it, but I disagree.
Yeah, it's not my favorite beer I've ever made.
It's good, but And then when we first started tinkering with Belgian sour beers, and they, you know, this was 6-7 years ago, I guess, when we really first started trying to figure that out. We had a couple of failures then.
Yeah.
A little, like, overly tart or overly kind of bacterial driven, and the public wasn't as up to speed as they are even today with those type of beers. So you put out a sour beer, and if people didn't really know what they were getting into, they didn't like them.
Well, I'm curious about that too, because I'm sure, I mean, Squatters, you guys are a pioneering part of this community in this state for so long now. No pun intended on the pioneer thing. But, and you probably do get a pretty sophisticated beer drinker in there, people who kind of know their way around. But I'm sure there's a certain amount of educating we, the public here, into things like that we're not being exposed to because of being in Utah, maybe. Is that a pretty common occurrence where you kind of have to showcase something off a little or explain it to somebody somehow and get the ball rolling.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I hate to harp on them, but sour beers are probably the biggest example of that where, you're right, we get a lot of what we would affectionately call beer geeks coming into a place like Squatters. But on the flip side, we also get a lot of out-of-town business and just your average kind of convention traveler or whoever's coming in there, and they may have no idea about sour beer. So we focus on educating our staff a lot. Like I do beer schools on a weekly, semi-weekly basis. Bring in our staff, make sure they know the basics about beer. And if we have sour beers available like we do right now, we have our Fifth Element and 529, which are both kind of, not kind of, those are both very tart sour beers. Yeah. We want to make sure that our staff knows before they sell somebody a $15 bottle of this beer that's been aging for a year and a half in oak casks in the basement, that the person isn't going to bring it back and say it's bad.
Right.
Just because they didn't understand the beer.
Yeah.
That does happen.
That would be annoying. I can imagine that that happening quite a bit. I think that's great. I really appreciate you coming in, Jason. It's
no problem.
Fun. I'd love to have you again sometime if you're into it.
Yeah.
Jason Stock, everybody, the head brewmaster at the Squatters Pub downtown. That is located at 147 West Broadway, squatters.com if you're on the internet. And if you're on the old twit machine, it's at Squatters Pubs on Twitter. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Year of the Wolf is an up-and-coming thrash punk band from Salt Lake City that formed almost 2 years ago in the spring of 2011, and last year they put out a little demo album in the middle of 2012. They've mostly been playing smaller gigs around town, but this month they're going to be part of the Slug Localize show. This is a song from that self-titled demo called 2-14-1929 Chicago, Illinois. This is Year of the Wolf.
Was a frosty morning and blood was in the air.
Will be playing the Slug Localized show this Friday, February 8th at the Urban Lounge, and they'll be opening for Chain Whip and Filth Lords. To find out more about the band, check them out online at facebook.com/Year of the Wolf.
It's already February, and Plan B Theater is just getting to its second production of a very busy season for them. The second show of the 2012-2013 year is called Adam and Steve in the Empty Sea, and it explores the relationship between two friends on either side of the gay LDS issue as told through the era of Proposition 8 over in California. The two struggle with faith, politics, sexuality, and the challenges of adulthood. Slug writer John Ford sat down with the play's two main actors, Topher Rasmussen and Logan Tarantino, to talk about the play and their personal reactions to the content.
Now, can you guys give us a little overview about the story? What's this play all about?
I don't know if we're going to, like, give anything away if we do that.
Well, maybe not.
Well, I mean, the synopsis that they sort of keep repeating is basically Adam is LDS, Steve is gay. This is happening in California during the Prop 8 nonsense. And essentially, we grow up together, and you get a sort of view of our struggles with growing up and with sexuality and religion and politics and just sort of two best friends learning to become adults together and see where their views can stand at that point. Mm-hmm.
So during certain points in the play, there are, you know, some confrontation, perhaps some confusion between the relationship of Adam and Steve, especially in their friendship, and especially once the whole Prop 8 issue comes into play.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Do either of you have strong holdings on either side of Prop 8, and did that affect the way you portray your characters?
I'm very much against Prop 8. I've always grown up being very supportive of gay and lesbian, that whole community, LGBT. My mom just kind of raised me like that, and I'm not LDS either. I kind of moved to Utah when I was kind of young, like when I was about 10. So I've lived here for a while, but I was one of the only people in my school that would kind of like stand up for gay people. Like if people were making fun of them or like talking really bad about gay people, like I'd kind of chime in a little bit and be like, well, I don't think they're bad, and I don't know if I can say this, but the way that I see it is it's not anyone else's business, but the people like trying to get their marriage. Like, who cares if someone else is married to each other if it's not their marriage? Like, if someone is happy with their straight marriage, they should just be happy with that and let the crazy sinning gay people, you know, like have their marriage. Like, I don't think it's, I just don't see how it really affects people. It seems like other people are putting themselves into other people's situations, so I think it's pointless, and it's not fair, it's not equal in America, and yeah, so that's, I'm very strongly against it.
As far as, like, the Prop 8, specifically with how the Mormon Church interacted with all that stuff, I was born in Provo, Utah, and I was raised LDS, and my family is still very active in the church, and I have a lot of strong ties to the Mormon religion, just because of my family and their perspectives, and, you know, my mom and both of my sisters, well, my older sister served a mission and my younger sister just got her call, and it's something that really brings my family together. Me personally, I've had a lot of problems with the religion specifically, and a lot of those problems sort of came to fruition, and I sort of decided where I stood because of this issue, because of not necessarily just Prop 8 and the marriage thing, because that's been clear to me the same way Logan was saying that marriage should be equal, and I think that it's a pointless view to have to try to ban anyone's marriage, and like Logan was saying, it's no one's business, you know, who you're married to. But the homosexuality in the LDS viewpoint, like how that functions and everything, has always been like it's just this thing that doesn't make any sense to me from like a Christian standpoint, and I don't necessarily identify with Christianity in every sense, but just the concept of homosexuality being something that you can stop loving someone over or excluding someone because of their sexual orientation, that has been a big, it's been a source of cognitive dissonance for me, and sort of, I don't know, led me to think a lot more about my, you know, personal religious views, and I don't know, it's a really important issue to me, and I'm straight myself. I've thought about homosexuality a lot, and I have some friends, and I don't know, it's been a big issue with me, this conflict between the religion and sexuality, and why it has to be such a big deal.
Thank you.
how well do each of you identify with your characters? We'll start with you, Logan.
Yeah, I feel very lucky because, one, he's young, like, so that's awesome. Like, it's kind of like graduating from high school, starting college, and like almost in the middle of college, which is exactly where I am. And he's not Mormon, and I'm not Mormon. And I don't know, like, it's, and I grew up in Utah having a lot of LDS friends and kind of like having the same conversations that we have in the play, kind of tiptoeing between like keeping a friendship but also talking about our religious differences. And I don't know, so it's really cool. Like I feel like it is almost me, except for, and I'm not gay either, so, but I don't know, I've just had a very strong like relationship with a lot of gay people, and my uncle was gay, and like I just kind of had grown up with it my whole life, so that is something that I can relate to. It's not like, oh, I've got to play a gay guy, uh-oh. Like, I mean, if you're in theater, you're it's kind of a given, but like you're just going to be surrounded by...
Wait, you're both straight and in theater?
Yeah, weird, I know, right? It's weird. It's
so anomalies, yeah.
But yeah, so and he's a jock. Like, he's all-star track runner. And I kind of was a jock until high school. Like, I was on the basketball team. I was the captain when I was, like, graduating from junior high. And then going into high school, I was going to continue... like being with the same people and doing like high school basketball. But that's actually when I started doing theater. So I don't know, there's really a lot that I can relate to, and he's like a good student and I'm a really good student too. No, yeah, so he's almost me except for the gay part. Like, so it really is really fun to play with.
I identify with Adam in a lot of ways. I really enjoy being able to play Adam as a child, specifically as a child that was raised Mormon. Because that played a huge part in my childhood, this idea of, you know, and it wasn't ever explicitly stated, but there's just this phenomenon with Mormon culture where, like, Mormon kids, at least in Utah, it was a lot more this way. I think in California, where the play happens, it's not as big of a deal, which I think, I don't know. Anyway, in Utah, there's this phenomenon where Mormon kids are sort of not really allowed to hang out with kids that aren't Mormon, or they're kind of not supposed to. And it's almost until high school that, you know, kids started to realize that it's really not that big a deal. But it was sort of like when you're little, like your parents might say, you know, oh, we don't really want to hang out with that family. They're not members, or, you know, they're heathens, or that whole thing. And so being able to sort of think about that and reflect on how my childhood went and how being Mormon as a child and interacting with other kids, because there's so many things you learn in primary in the church that you would repeat to your friends. You know, and Adam does a lot of that. He does a lot of talking about things he learns in church to Steve. And it's not anything that's preachy. It's not anything. It's just like, it's little, it's almost trivia. Just like ways that he talks about stuff. And it's something that I really do relate to and can understand. I'm coming from this viewpoint. And I also have, I don't know about percentages, but I have a large number of very active Mormon friends that I deeply respect and are very intelligent that may have views that are different than mine. And so I can completely relate to the way that Adam thinks, where he has problems with the idea of homosexuality. He has problems with that being a sin. And he mentioned something about, well, it's not that we're not into the people, but, you know, it's just gayness that we think is wrong. And I can relate to that idea specifically because I've heard it so much, or that argument, though I may disagree with that point. It's easy for me to play that side of the argument because I've been familiar with it. And I don't know, I relate to Adam a lot. And as far as like socially, like in high school, I don't know, I feel like Adam is sort of, well, they're both on the track team and I wasn't ever really into sports very much, but I think their relationship and their relationship dynamic is something that it's very familiar to me with friends that I look up to, or, you know, friends that I seek advice from. And so yeah, I relate to Adam in a lot of ways.
Now, the play also focuses a lot on friendship. What about friendship do you think is so important, not just to the story, but to life in general?
I have this, since I like sort of started to think my own way about religion when I was maybe 17 or so, I started to come up with these like set of beliefs for myself of like how I thought about things instead of, you know, someone telling me. And one of the things that I put it into some interesting terms, I don't know if this is something that is a weird thing to talk about, but how I interpreted certain religions, because I try to make a middle ground between, you know, like somewhere between like atheism and strict LDS thought. I try to figure out how I can be friends with both and how I can try to hold both ideas in my head, because I don't identify as an atheist or as strictly LDS, but I have a lot of these ideas in my head. So one of the things was, you know, the first commandment is to love God, which I've interpreted as loving yourself. And then your second commandment is to love thy neighbor. So that, I think, is what I've sort of identified as the reason for existing, is connecting with other people. And I think that you have closer bonds with your friends than even with your family a lot of times. You can be more honest with your friends, especially people that are your age. Like, you have this connection that you don't have with anyone else, even like siblings. Like, you can say anything to certain friends, especially like a best friend type, which Adam and Steve are very much best friends. And there's just so much that you can't say to anyone else that you can say to your best friend. I think that it's incredibly important that friendship and close friendships like that are vitally important to existence.
Going off of that, I was gonna say, I think like the most important thing about having a friend is it's just like kind of the role that they play in what you're doing with your life. Like, if your parents are taking care of you, quote unquote, like, and showing you the exact right things that you should be doing, I think that friends are the people that you can go to that like can identify with the wrong things that you might be doing, and like all of the experimentation that goes on with being a teenager, like, well, going through like your whole childhood up until you kind of learn who you are, I guess.
If that happens.
Yeah.
If you learn who you are.
Yeah, if you can ever know who you are. Yeah, and I was gonna say, like, when I think about my best friends, I've got this guy named TJ, and he's actually very LDS, and we've been friends since childhood. And then my little sister and I have a super close relationship, and it's like, they're both kind of my best friends, I think. And I can tell some people certain things and like joke in a certain way that I know I couldn't do around anyone else. And it, like, even with the two different friends, even though they're both like super close to me, I can tell people things and like just like the advice that I get. And it's kind of like going through what I'm going through with someone else that's around my same age and like same maturity level or whatever. And just kind of like having a partner to, instead of like going through it alone, if you can have the privilege of like having someone else to kind of be a backup for you, like that's got your back, you know? I think that that is just like what's most important, just the security and just being honest in ways that you can't with other people.
What influence do you think this play will have on the LGBT community? And perhaps more importantly, on the relationship between the LGBT community and the LDS community?
I don't really know. I don't know if I can predict like anything that would happen.
Yeah.
As far as like my, I don't know. It really has like, I don't know about changed, like, you know, made me switch positions on how I feel about these issues, but I do feel like, I don't know, it brings up this conversation in such an innocent, I don't know, it's a really, like, it's a smart way to talk about this issue that people can get so emotional about. And I'm really excited for my family to see the play, and my best friend specifically, who they're all, you know, strong LDS. And I mean, I think we've talked a little bit about how, you know, it can be, what effect this play could have on someone who thinks as LDS. But as far as like an LGBT individual experiencing this play, I think, I don't know, like, in a lot of ways, it's easy to, it's really easy to think of LDS people as ignorant when you're coming from that perspective, or even just like equality, just like when it's really easy to call someone a bigot, you know, who doesn't agree with you, which I think isn't a healthy way to discuss it, and I don't think that it's a healthy opinion to have. I mean, that's just disrespectful and unloving, as much as, you know, saying you can't get married is, you know. And so I think that it's a really good way to be able to sort of balance both perspectives and say, maybe this isn't idiocy, you know, or like both, like, it's just, it's a really equal, it's both sides thing. And this, the reality is, this question, like, if the answer was easy, I think we would have got there by now, you know. The discussion isn't over yet, even though, you know, 2008 passed, but like, we're still like in Supreme Court, there's going to be stuff on gay marriage. And I think in 20 years, you know, maybe we'll be at some point where at least legally it's fine, but I don't think that it's something that we're going to get. I mean, we still aren't rid of racism, you know? Like, I just think, like, it's a big issue, and I don't know. Like, I just hope this play can contribute to the discussion in a healthy way.
I was going to say, it's not really, like, a play that is completely coming on bashing the opposite way and saying, like religion is wrong. The main thing that, you know, it doesn't agree with the play is, like, the idea of Prop 8. But it's not saying, like, like LDS people are bad, gay people are bad. It finds a very nice middle ground, and that's the whole point. Like, if best friends can find a way to still love each other, like, what's more important, like, love or your specific views, and are you going to let that tear away people that you love? The really nice thing was we did a reading, we did a stage reading during the summer, and the play was actually a little bit different than it is now. It's still getting some minor edits on it and everything, but it did have, for the most part, I think it had a pretty good reaction from the LGBT community, because that's who we're reading it for.
Yeah, it was at the Outreach Conference. It was like a group of LGBT individuals. It was, yeah.
Yeah, and people could really identify with Steve in a lot of ways, I think, and like with the friendship that was going on. I hope that it doesn't come off as being, and I don't think it will, come off as being anything stereotypical or anything offensive. I think it has been ringing pretty true so far, so I really am excited for LDS people to see it. Like my best friend that's going to be coming, every LDS person that comes in Utah that's going to like see it, as well as the LGBT community. I think it's going to be really powerful and hopefully be kind of like a possible outcome of what society could do. Like, it's almost like a metaphor, I think. Instead of like two friends, it could be the whole world will love each other after this play. But yeah, that's kind of what I think. I'm really excited for both parties, I guess we could call them.
Adam and Steve and the MDC kicked off its run on January 31st at the Studio Theater in the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, located at 138 West Broadway in downtown Salt Lake City. The play runs through February 10th, and tickets are just $20 for general admission, $10 for students. For more information on the play, check out planbtheater.org. This is your weekly daily calendar for the week starting on February 5th. And as always, you'll want to go to slugmag.com. Gee, every day you should really go check that out, because there is always new content coming in, always new listings going up. And of course, you are free to add your own listings for your events. Just go online, do that. For an extra little $5 a month or $50 a year, you can add some quality content, like some photos, some links, some video, whatever you like. Once again, that is slugmag.com, and go check out that daily calendar. Some really good stuff up this week. On February 5th, Glossary, a really fine roots rock band, are headlining at Bar Deluxe. And if jazz is more your scene, Branford Marsalis, one of the legendary Marsalis clan out of New Orleans, is headlining at Kingsbury Hall. I am far from being a jazz guy, but I love me some Branford Marsalis. I've seen him a couple times in concert. If you want to see someone who is just a master of their instrument, go check Branford out at Kingsbury Hall. On the 6th of February, Ken Stringfellow, who people might remember from the Posies, and who also went on to play with REM quite a bit in a lot of different combinations out of the Seattle scene, he's headlining at Urban Lounge. That'll be a treat for a lot of us. On the 7th of February, you have Joe McQueen doing his regular date the first Thursday of the month at the Garage. Always great to hear Joe McQueen blowing on his saxophone. You have a Grateful Dead cover band at Urban Lounge that same night. That could be a little frightening. Slug Localized on the 8th includes Filth Lords, Chain Whip, and Year of the Wolf. You're hearing some of that music right here on this very podcast. And that same weekend, it's Vivace, who is doing a little show called No Passport Needed. Vivace, if you don't know, is a great youth-oriented group for people who don't really know classical or opera but want to get together with some like-minded, perhaps uneducated, and I throw myself in there, for shows at Abravanel Hall or at the Capitol Theater for the opera. Always a good time. They usually throw in a party afterwards where you get to mingle with the musicians and the artists who you just saw perform afterwards, so always a treat. If you go to the Abravanel Hall or the Utah Symphony website, you can track down a little Vivace action right there. Once again, be sure to check out slugmag.com for all of your listings of events coming up here. There's always new stuff added every day. And tune in again next week for another weekly daily calendar. Here Here we have another band playing in the Slug Localized show this week. This is Chain Whip, a five-piece punk band from Salt Lake City that originally formed in the fall of 2011 and quickly started playing some big shows at Bert's Tiki Lounge and around town. They released a self-titled demo album in 2012 as well. We're going to play a song off of that called Rats in the Walls. This is Chain Whip.
My mom can't believe me, it wasn't my fault. I swear it was rats, the rats of the wall. Bang and dead, fire and wall. There's the rats, that's on the wall. That fucking sap, that's on the bed. Up on its source, then I'll be put. I can't fucking set up, lose my mind.
Once again, you can catch Chain Whip live this Friday at the Slug Localized show at the Urban Lounge, along with Year of the Wolf and Filth Lords. To find out more about the band, check them out online at facebook.com/chainwhipband. Revolution United is a relatively new community-based organization based out of Salt Lake City that gets funds together and donates them to create different projects around town focused on informing and helping out the community. They try to make sure that all of their funding is 100% transparent and all of their activities are as well, allowing the public to see where the money goes that they donate to the cause. Slug writer Leandra Jeff sat down with the founder, David Brooks, to talk about Revolution United.
So what is Revolution United?
Revolution United is a 501c3 Utah charitable nonprofit organization that's all about bringing the community together and taking back the power from wherever it's at right now and putting it back into the hands of the community without involving religion or politics or anything else really. It's really just all about human beings coming together and realizing that we're the ones that can really make the difference in the community, and it's ours to change, and it's been ours the entire time.
How long has Revolution United been up and running now?
We incorporated back in January of 2012, so about a year.
What gave you inspiration to start a nonprofit?
That's a funny question. I was meditating a lot back in 2008 and realized that there's so much that can be done to really make a difference in the world, and there's so many wrongs that are happening and mm-hmm. so much corruption and lies and abuse, and I mm-hmm. figured that there's got to be some way, something that I could do personally, and I meditated on trying to figure out a system that could possibly make a real difference, and I came up with this.
And who and what kind of people are involved with you right now?
Oh, everybody. Engineers, architects, musicians, mm-hmm. artists, anybody who's wanting to be involved with making a positive impact in the community. It's really open to anybody who has a passion for change.
And how do you incorporate different types of people like that onto one project that you're working on?
So usually what happens with the project is the community, so it's totally open forum. So whoever has a project idea, they can post it and share it with people in organization. And we figure out which one to actually develop, and we get them incorporated by pretty much figuring out what it is we need on the project. So if we need an artist, we'll contact a list of artists that we have that have shown interest in getting involved, or if we need some sort of someone that can handle some architecture or someone engineering wise, or just project managers, anyone that has really any skills. If they want skills, it's a great opportunity for them to get involved as well, to learn new stuff and put that on their resumes if they ever want to.
So I've heard a little bit about this thing called an idea silo. Tell me a little more about that.
Idea Silo is probably our staple event where the community just comes out, it's open to the public, and we put up a bunch of pretty much whiteboards along the room, and people post their ideas on post-it notes on what we can do as a community to make a difference in specific sectors such as health, you know, so we'll come up with a health project. And then at the end of the night, we vote on which project is the most efficient, and we develop an actual plan for that project right then and there on the spot. So we have something to start with, and then we can start finding volunteers to actually get involved, and then we set up meetings. We also invite a local nonprofit organization to share what they do as well, and we also bring in a special guest speaker who has a good amount of knowledge within the community already, someone that can share something so people can go there, share their ideas, and also get new ideas at the same time and be inspired.
I mean, how do you organize and get word out about the idea silos?
Mostly through Facebook. Really, we make a few flyers and then just give them to people involved with the organization, and they'll pass them out when they just go to bars and when they go to a show or just whenever. It's really, getting people involved is a really interesting dynamic thing to do. It's probably the toughest thing in the organization.
How would someone get involved in a project that they're interested in?
You can go to our Facebook page, contact the organization, you can email anybody involved with the organization, just go to our website, and we have a list of all the projects that we're currently developing, so you can see which one is most interesting to you and just click it, and then it'll give you the opportunity to go to the next meeting or be a part of whatever is necessary for that project. And like, we have a full list of everything that we need for it, so it's very open source. It should be very easy for people to find something that they have passion for and be able to make an impact in it right away.
And then how many months ahead do you usually plan your events?
That all depends. Indie Undergrounds, we usually have 3 months period, like breathing room, to pretty much plan those. Idea Silos, like a month. So it all depends on how grand the project is, like the Off the Chain Festival, which was a 3-day event that raised over $1,000 for Xing Animal Farm and Rescue. That we were planning that one for a long time, just because we had to coordinate with the city to march through the streets, and we had like 30 performers and in 3 different venue spaces, so that one took a long time. So it all depends, and we try and be as efficient as possible with people's time, because we know that's by far the most important thing that all of us have is time, so trying to be as efficient as possible with that.
I mean, you just said something about Indie Underground, so tell me a little more about that and then about your other projects and events you're working on right now.
Indie Underground, it's an event put on by Revolution United and Salsandini Arts. Rebecca May is the main coordinator for this project, and she's been doing a fantastic job. And what it's all about is getting the community together to bring art. It's pretty much like a large art festival in one night.
Oh, wow.
To where we try and get different genres of music all together in one scene and bring them all together to show that, you know, we can work together as a community, as artists, because artists are the leaders. They're the ones that that have always led the way for new ideas, for new movements, for anything. And we bring them all together in one show and bring musicians, artists, poets. We're getting into getting some actors on stage as well, putting some skits together.
Okay.
And yeah, just pretty much entertaining and bringing the community together and having a good time. Some other projects we've done, Ride and Shoot Scavenger Hunt, where we get people to put teams together and ride around the city on their bicycles, pretty much finding cool things within businesses and in the streets, and they have to take an Instagram picture, and the team with the most points ends up winning.
Cool. So when is the next Indie Underground, or how often do you usually do those?
They're every 3 months, and the next one we're looking to do in late March.
How do you raise funds for events?
So we raise funds a number of different ways. The standard ways that any other 501c3 organization raises funds through grants. through donations online, through donations in person. But we do some fun things at tables wherever we set up a booth. For events, we have fun games for people to play to where they can donate a dollar and they can win a prize. We're incorporating a new system to where we are going to do something similar to the church, to where the church has a bunch of subsidiary companies, and each of those subsidiary companies automatically gives a certain percentage back to the organization. So for example, people in the community know that a new community farm or community market is out there that is affiliated with Revolution United, people will go to that farm or market instead, and those profits go back to the organization to make more things happen.
How many people do you currently have volunteering under you?
I'd say roughly 50, 50 to 60 that have been involved with all of our projects, and if you include musicians and artists, that puts us well over 100, because every event we have, there's usually musicians and art, and so it's getting up there. We've racked up over 1,000 hours of volunteer time now in this year, and that's something to be proud of. And I just want to say thank you to everyone that's already been involved. We've done a fantastic job, and considering the fact it's only been 1 year, we've done a lot in this year. And we're looking forward to much bigger projects that make grander changes.
And why do you think change is so important right now?
I feel like it's our time. We've been waiting for so many years now, and we've been aware of all the issues for so long. And I feel like it's finally, with the technology that we have in our hands, we can unite and we can bring people together, and we can actually make the changes that we want to see. We've been, like a lot of people, they've been living them, like the Gandhi saying, we've been the change we wanted to see, but now it's time to really extend that and find other people that are wanting the same changes and the same things, and just bringing them together. So what we do is find nonprofit organizations that are already focusing on specific like sectors and create a project that unites them all. So it's the organization and the community and individuals all coming together for something that we all have passion for.
And then what is your vision? Where do you see Revolution United going in 20 years?
The system of Revolution United, I'd love to see implemented everywhere. I feel like we have a very horizontal democratic system where anyone can propose an idea, and if everyone else likes it, then we'll do it. I'd love to see something like this happen in somewhere overseas where it can absolutely make real changes to where some people in the community in Africa see something going on and they want to come together and they can somehow pool funds and make it happen. And Revolution United is a 501c3, so it allows for other businesses to invest in them, and they get their tax deductions as well. Overall, what I'd like to see is for Revolution United to be eventually forgotten, ideally, you know, because it's more than a movement. It's not the Revolution United. I'm not big on putting that out there all the time. I'd really like to see people just make change themselves. And they can know that they can come to this resource to find other people that have the similar passions to make a difference. But once they find those people, you know, it's all them. It's them making it happen. It's not necessarily Revolution United. So really, I'd like to see Revolution United be the backer of major projects, and the people be the ones that are the power of the projects.
For more information on Revolution United, their projects, funding, and getting involved yourself, visit them online at revolutionunited.org. As always, thank you very much for listening to the Sound Waves from the Underground podcast. We will be back next week when we're going to dig into, Mummies at the Leo, a local table and band singles, the idea we have to match up single musicians with bands out there with a hole in them. If you know anybody who fits that bill, you'll want to let us know. Send us an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. That line is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We just might be able to match you up with the perfect band for you or your lonely musician friend that you have out there. This podcast, as always, created by Slug Magazine and produced by Gavin Sheehan. The associate producers are Esther Moronio, Ricky Vigil, Alexander Ortega, and myself, Dan Nalen. Executive producer is Angela H. Brown. The theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. Main logo and art design is by T. Doan, and technical design is by Kate Colgan. Thank you very much.